Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How might the diagnosis of a learning disability affect your child's prospects in school and in adulthood? As many as 1 in 5 American kids are affected by learning differences like dyslexia, sensory processing disorder, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, better known as ADHD. My guest today understands their challenges well. He's known about his dyslexia and ADHD since fifth grade, after several agonizing years of being told he was to blame for his struggles in school because he simply wasn't trying hard enough. Flink's learning differences did not keep him from earning degrees at Brown and Columbia, but they did steer him toward a commitment to advocacy for bright young students whose brains don't work in typical ways. David Flink is co-founder and CEO of the student mentoring organization Eye to Eye, and he's just written a book called Thinking Differently, an inspiring guide for parents of children with learning disabilities. Dave, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
So it's one thing for your teachers to have noticed you struggling. At what point did you realize that things that came easily to your classmates were somehow much harder for you?
Wow, that's a really terrific question. It's something I think I've been unpacking in the process of actually writing this book. I would actually say I knew something was up probably by the second or third grade. And kids, I think, often actually have an awareness that they're not succeeding even before their teachers know or their parents know. It was hard to be a third grader and not doing well at your one job, which was to do well in school.
How did your struggles make you feel about going to school?
So, I remember a moment when school stopped being fun. And it came right around, like I sort of said, third grade. And what happened is, the things that I was supposed to be able to do well, I just stopped being able to do them. So a great example, you switch from learning to read to reading to learn. And with my dyslexia, I just wasn't learning to read. And so I couldn't read to learn. And I watched my friends, they did this so naturally. And two things came from that. One is I thought, well, gosh, I must be stupid, which is a horrible way to go to school every day.
Yeah.
And two is I actually found myself separating from my friends. So I lost the social network because I couldn't relate to them.
And so, of course, along with that came some behavioral issues at school.
Oh, yeah. My poor teachers and the administrators at the school. So around the same time, my parents, they were aware that something was going on. Obviously, my grades were coming home and I was not doing particularly well. And they were clever enough to figure out that they needed to keep my self-esteem up. So they had decided that whatever I was interested in, they were going to support, which was great and something that at Eye to Eye we recommend thoroughly. But to the dismay, perhaps, of my teachers, the hobby which they were celebrating was magic. I had taken up an interest in, producing quarters out of people's ears and lighting fireballs spontaneously. And so I brought that to school. So what happened is I realized quickly it was easier to be the bad kid than it was to be the dumb kid. Indeed, I started acting out. So I was asked to read out loud, and indeed, I would produce a fireball in the middle of class and became, on the first name basis with the principal because off I went. And, doing that trick over enough period of time, I started identifying as being the bad kid. And now in my adult life, I'll tell people these stories and they think, how is this person that we know the kid who was lighting fireballs in class? And the answer is it was just survival. And it got worse. I mean, the fireballs were probably the highlight, if you will, because by the time fifth grade rolled around, it was, Dave, can you read out loud? And I was, my self-esteem was gone. I was bankrupt. And so, a fireball would have been a gift because what I actually did was punch the kid to the right of me.
Yeah.
Because I was angry. And I wasn't a violent kid, and I loved people. My mom's a teacher. I came from a real background of community service, and yet I was just acting out. And thank goodness for the label. It was in fifth grade where someone said, we should get Dave tested. And that's when I learned that I was both dyslexic and ADHD. And there was so much power in that label. It explained so many things for me.
I'm so glad you brought this up because it comes up in the book. And it's an issue that a lot of people struggle to figure out which side to belong on. Some people feel as if the labels are, will stick with you and be, an avenue for stigma. But your sense was that this reframed the things you had struggled with and suddenly gave you a direction to move in.
Yeah. You know, I hear a lot of parents say, I don't want to get my kid tested because I don't want them to be labeled. I don't want them to be labeled. Well, kids will find other labels that are much worse than dyslexic or learning disability. They get the labels of lazy or stupid or crazy. And they don't realize that the kids will find those labels sort of organically. So for me, I unfortunately had already kind of ascribed to those labels. And when fifth grade rolled around and I got tested, I had this word, this amazing word, two words actually, right? Dyslexic, ADHD. And those two words gave me access to a community. I suddenly understood that I wasn't alone, that one in five people in America learn just like I do. That's huge. I didn't know the other people in my class, unfortunately, that learned like that. But, you know, doing the math, it was clear I had a class of 30 students. So there was at least, you know, four or five, maybe six other people who learned like that. And then the second piece that it gave me is an explanation. So I wasn't stupid. I just learned differently. And my whole world changed after I got those labels in so many productive ways. Many of those things I tried to outline in this book so that families, A, could get their kids labeled sooner, but B, find a pathway to success, because we want all kids to learn productively and happily.
It's worth noting here as well that untreated learning differences can be associated with some really devastating long-term consequences.
Yeah, I debated whether to bring that out in the book, and I chose to because I think it's important that people know. So if you thought about the one in five people in America that have a learning disability, it actually is one of the largest minority groups in our country, just if you think about it in those terms. And then if you think about the success rates, that population fails at almost the highest rate of any student population in America. So students with learning disabilities drop out of school twice as often as students without learning disabilities. And learning disabilities don't discriminate. So every kid has equal opportunity to have a learning disability. It doesn't matter what socioeconomic status you come from, what your race is, what your religion is. We all have a chance. And I actually describe it as a chance because you're right, the stats aren't great. Less than 2% of all kids with learning disabilities now graduate from a four-year college, although my nonprofit, IDEI, is working to change that. But on the other side, some of our greatest thinkers in America and in the world also think and learn differently. So there's a huge upside if we capitalize on it.
You're candid that parents beginning their journey with a child who has learning differences might need to reset their expectations for that child. Tell us about how families can balance the reality of particular challenges and limitations while still encouraging their children to reach their full potential and not necessarily assume that they can't do whatever they want to do.
Yes, it's a really great question because one of the things I've learned is that families often want their kids to love the things that they love. So in my household, you know, my mom was a teacher. She still is a teacher, actually. And she loved books. She loved reading books. And, you know, when I think of reading a book, I think of my mom sitting in the living room with the book open, reading with her eyes. And she really had to be okay with the idea that I was going to read books differently. It didn't mean that I wasn't going to read and love books, but I was going to end up reading books with my ears. So those kind of little expectations take a lot for people to shift. When they do, when they begin to understand that their kids can still achieve greatness, they may just achieve it in a very different way, then they can do a lot to help them. So the easy example was I really did love magic. It's still a hobby of mine. And I wanted to read books on it. And my parents said, well, let's go to the library and see what we can find. Well, at the time, it was very difficult to find books on tape. But my parents said, we're going to find that. And there was a great organization. At the time, it was called Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic. Now it's called Learning Ally. But they would send you all these books in an audio format. And all of a sudden, I had access to all of this, you know, magic mystery that I could read with my ears and learn how to do magic tricks.
I want to talk for a minute about ADHD because so many people have coped with this either personally or through the lens of a child that they care about. On the other hand, there are other people in America who say this is a behavioral issue that has to do with parenting. Tell us, can you, as an adult who is still coping with this, what it feels like to have ADHD?
What does it feel like to have ADHD? It's as though you're watching TV and the channels are changing and you don't have control of the remote. That's probably the best example I can think of. On the plus side, I can take in a lot of data all the time. My brain is always moving, and it's people think of it as a deficit in attention, but it's really not. It's an attention surplus. So I can take in all of this data, but the bad side is I can't always stay on one task for a really long time. So now in my adult life, you know, I'll go out to dinner with my wife, and God bless her, she knows all about my ADHD. We joke that we have an inter-able relationship. She has a very normal thinking brain. And we'll go out to dinner, and they'll sit me down, and she'll look to see what's around us for me. And if there's a TV in the background with the game on, our dinner's lost. And they'll say, hey, can we move tables? Mm. And she's really great about it. And so one of the things that I think having ADHD and being with others that do have ADHD, you can understand each other immediately. But when you're with folks like my wife who think in more traditional terms, you have to be able to understand each other. The plus side of it is that this different way of thinking can lead to some incredible and sometimes surprising insights. And certainly my nonprofit is probably the best insight I think I've been able to come across these years. So many people thought, you know, people with learning disabilities needed to be fixed. They needed to be sort of the subject of service. And I said, well, my different thinking brain jumped to the idea of maybe we can do service. And that's kind of the bedrock of what Eye to Eye does. So ADHD has gifts and flaws just like anything else.
How did you begin to see yourself not as a troublemaker but as one of the smart kids?
Every day I'm getting closer to thinking of myself as one of the smart kids. there's a lot of emotions I think you have to unpack when you spend a lot of your early childhood struggling in school. But I think a pivot point happened for me when I went to Brown. I had been told, sometimes even explicitly, that I wouldn't go to college. And I believed that. So when I went to Brown, I thought, wow, you know, this is something that I hadn't even dreamed was possible. And I struggled initially at Brown because I didn't embrace all the different ways that I needed to go through the experience of learning at a pretty competitive school. So getting extra time on test and using accommodations like that ended up being crucial. But as I started to embrace those accommodations, I started to do well. And then I met other people who also were willing to talk about their learning disabilities. And I said, oh, they're smart and they're here too. And so much of my reframing of myself as an intelligent person came from meeting others who could say, yeah, I have dyslexia and I wrote a book. In fact, when I sat down to write this book, I was really fortunate to meet another dyslexic author, Philip Schultz, who wrote a book called My Dyslexia. And I remember I was kind of freaking out. And he said, David, this isn't uncommon. Smart people write books who have dyslexia. Move on. I was like, that's all he said. That's literally all he said. And I said, oh, okay. So it's a lifelong journey for sure. But knowing other people and hearing stories help. So much of this book, not only did I try and include tools that can really help parents, but I also really tried to include stories that people can see themselves in, because we need to know we're not alone.
We're speaking this hour with David Flink, co-founder and CEO of Eye to Eye, which is a mentoring organization for students, and author of the new book, Thinking Differently, an inspiring guide for parents of children with learning disabilities. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David Flink, co-founder and CEO of the mentoring organization Eye to Eye and author of the new book Thinking Differently, an inspiring guide for parents of children with learning disabilities. Send email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Dave, for parents who have considered having their children tested, have been recommended for having their children tested, talk about what the process is like and the best ways to prepare kids to go through this and understand what the results may be.
Well, one resource that I actually would love to mention just out the gate, which is it's actually just coming out, so our listeners here can hear it for the first time, is it's a resource called Understood. And it's a website which you can go to right now and sign up. It's going to be launching in the next couple of weeks. And it's actually a place where you can start to see what the testing environment is going to look like. You can actually experience what it might look like if your kid has a learning disability. So I think it's really important for parents to go, particularly to a site like that. There are others, but that one sounds like it's going to be just best in class. So they know before they even go in what their kids might feel like. After doing that, and I definitely recommend going to understood.org, I would say you should look around. There's lots of different people in the community who can do this kind of testing, but you should actually start, if your kid's in a public school, you should start with the school. The people who spend the time with your kids the most are the ones who are going to kind of know what's going on. And every parent is actually entitled, if requested in writing, to have their kid tested. A testing process will take a couple of days. It's important to let the kids know that this isn't going to evaluate how smart they are or how good they are, how much you love them. All those things you should, you know, kind of lay out up front. But it will help them understand how they're going to be able to do best in school. And from that testing, you can go on, if the kid receives a diagnosis, then you can start to place a plan within the school, whether it be what's called a 504 plan or an IEP. Both are legal documents that the parent has with the school that make sure that the kid's entitled to what's called a least restrictive learning environment. And all those jargonized words really just mean a kid's going to be able to be successful in their classroom.
Yeah, and it should be clear to parents, their kids have a lot of rights, if they have this diagnosis, to be given special accommodations, to be educated in a way that works for them.
Absolutely. And you know, one of the arguments I try to make in the book is the idea that there's no such thing as a learning disability. Let me take a pause there. Learning disabilities are a real thing. You can do plenty of testing to see how they look real, but learning disabilities surface in context. Hmm. So right now, talking to you, I don't have dyslexia. You're not asking me to do any reading out loud, so we are all good. As soon as I have to do some reading out loud, you would see my dyslexia. So learning happens in between a person and their environment. And that's what's happening in school. And so all testing would do was be able to help a kid change their learning environment. And that's where I started to feel success. And in Eye to Eye, what we're able to do is help our mentees actually ask for those learning environments and change their learning environments. So parents can do a lot in terms of creating these documents with schools, but also kids can have a voice in the process, because a lot of times kids know what they're passionate about and when they do best. They just need to be able to bring that to the places where they're struggling.
What would you recommend as effective ways of communicating about these learning differences with teachers and also with students' peers who may say, hey, well, why does Dave get extra time to take a test, or why does Dave get to type his reports when I have to handwrite mine in a blue book?
Those are both great questions, and I think you handle them really differently. So in terms of talking with the teachers, I always start off as a partnership, and then if it goes sour, then maybe you need to get a little more firm. So starting with parents having a conversation with the teachers and saying, you know, we're really noticing Kimberly or, you know, Sam's coming home and they're not happy. And maybe you're seeing that in the classroom too. And if the answer is yes, you can start a really productive conversation about why. And I would really recommend that as kids get older, that the kids are brought into that conversation. Around middle school, a parent can be an advocate for their kid, but then they can go home and have a kind of a practice run with their kid. So say that, you know, they find out that the kid really does need extra time on a test or maybe a less distractive testing environment. They can set that up with the school, but then say to their kid, you know, it would be really great if you went and talked to the teacher about this. Because what that does is it trains the kid to be able to learn how to advocate for themselves. Because later on in life, they're going to need to learn how to do that. So it's good to have that training. Now, talking with peers, I think, is a little different. Because when you're talking with peers, you're really trying to help them understand that they're not cheating, right? They're not doing something that is unfair, that they're getting some kind of advantage. And I think some of the best ways to do that are to conjure the stories of people. I jokingly say I'm part of the LDADHD Republic. So bring up stories from our people. There's so many wonderful stories of celebrities who, you know, they may resonate with, like Orlando Bloom, who talks very openly about how he's dyslexic. So they can say, you know, why do I get extra time? Well, I get extra time the same reason that Orlando Bloom gets extra time. Both of us struggle with reading. But both of us, when we get a little extra time, can do well on the test. And that's all that is. So I think it's helpful to bring up sort of pop culture people that other kids may know, so it becomes less weird.
I guess it's not so different than saying, is it cheating that I get to wear eyeglasses to work every day because my eyes don't focus properly?
That's the best example right there, too. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because sometimes I'll tell kids that exact example. And that makes it real. The hardest part, I think, about learning disabilities is that they're invisible. So we have to figure out ways to make them more visible.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Brett in Louisville. Hello, Brett.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for doing the show.
Sure.
I am so relating to what you're saying. I'm dyslexic as well, and it was like you were speaking my story itself. I actually wrote a commentary for KERA about it. I'm curious what your opinion is on like high-stakes testing and things like that and how that can affect the kids. I was actually looking at what we call the STAR test here in Texas. And I loved math and I loved science. I had extremely high aptitude in that. But now I look at the math test in Texas and it's actually all word problems. And I'm like, oh my God, that would have crushed me when I was a kid. So I would love to hear your opinion on that.
Awesome. Well, first I have to say, Brett, I so appreciate that you led with, hey, I'm part of the Dyslexic Republic, because I think that's awesome. That's one of the ways that we make our stories visible. So thanks for leading with that. High-stakes testing is really tricky. Honestly, at this point right now, I don't feel that high-stakes testing are doing a true service for our students across the board, not just students with learning disabilities, but all students, because we're spending more time thinking about how well they do on the test and whether or not they're actually good learners. But I don't think they're going away. So I think we have to be really conscious of the fact that they're here and they're going to be here for a long time. So my biggest sort of advocacy point on it is making sure that all kids get fair testing environments. If we're going to make every kid take these tests, and I feel strongly that all kids should take them. I know there was some discussion at one point to have kids with learning disabilities actually not take the test. And I thought that sent a really bad message to how important our kids are. I mean, 1 in 5 kids don't take the test. That says they don't matter. So I think we need all kids taking the test. We just need to make sure we get all kids' accommodations in place. I hope there'll come a day when we can all raise our voices and say, wait a second, what's school about? Is it really about doing well on these tests, or is it about learning? And that's a bigger battle, but I think we're all in it together, and there's a lot of people who, over time, will be able to make enough noise to make that change happen. Thanks for the question. I think it's a great question.
Are accommodations typically available in the workplace?
They are. They're under different laws. So outside of K through 12, all Americans are protected under something called the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. And in the same spirit that students in school are entitled to a least restrictive learning environment, in the workplace, you can't discriminate against anybody because of any disability. At the IDI offices, which are filled with people who have learning disabilities, we actually make a particular effort to hire people who have learning disabilities. We think a lot about how to make sure that our work environment is super productive for everybody. And it gets into some really interesting conversations. And I think in some ways we're living in the future at the IDI offices, because the things that people ask for are often things that people may be a little uncomfortable asking for in their typical jobs, but we find they're really productive. And then we tell everyone about it. So they're definitely protected in the work environment. And if folks have questions about how to have those conversations, they should feel free to call our offices. I think my next book might be called Working Differently, because I think that there's a lot of questions about that. But I haven't written that one yet.
Well, give us some examples, though, of the kinds of things that people have asked for that have allowed them to be productive despite a learning difference.
So believe it or not, if you come into the IDI offices, you will see a fair amount of people sitting on bouncy balls in exchange for their sort of normal chairs. And people, I think, are uncomfortable asking for that. But what we've learned in the science is that movement facilitates learning. So all of my staff members who have ADHD can just sit on a big inflatable bouncy ball all day long, and as they kind of shake back and forth and move, they're able to be productive. I had a friend who worked, they were working at an accounting office, and he had ADHD, and he found that the noise of the office was very distracting because, like I said, it's not like you have a deficit in attention, you have a surplus. So everything happening around him was distracting him. And so he was a great advocate, and he went to his boss and he said, I'd like some noise-canceling headphones. And it just, I know it's going to look weird. You know, it's these big headphones I'm going to have in the middle of this office, and people will probably think I'm rocking out to my Beats, but I really am just turning out the noise. And that they permitted it, and that was a great use of advocacy and accommodations. I think progressive employers understand that these accommodations aren't unrealistic, and in fact, they'll get the best out of their employees if they really embrace the way they learn.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Mary in Fort Worth. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you knew about a form of dyslexia in which the person can't spell. My daughter, you know, can read and everything, but she cannot spell. We spent thousands of dollars on private tutoring with dyslexia, and it just doesn't work. And I didn't. What do you have an idea about that?
Oh, I know it intimately. Your daughter and I, and your daughter and me, share a very similar kind of dyslexia. I have trouble with reading and spelling, so it's very common. Although we don't talk about it enough, so a lot of times what happens is with dyslexia, there's as you may know, a breakdown between the symbol and the sound. So kids have trouble when they produce the sound and they're trying to write it on a piece of paper. They can't figure out what letter to write. They don't know what sound it's connecting to. There's a bunch of different methods out there. I'm sure you may have been exposed to some of them. I was trained with Orton-Gillingham, which is a method that worked really well for me. What I would say is, thankfully, your daughter lives in a very different time than when I was growing up. So I think it's important to continue to have your daughter try and learn, you know, great spelling skills. But at some level, it's okay if your daughter just uses the spell check built into practically every electronic device we have now.
We have a tweet here from Lynn who says, I'd love to hear David talk about how parents can balance being their child's advocate with teaching self-advocacy.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's very age dependent. So I think when kids are young, parents really have to be their kid's best advocate. They have to go in, and you don't want to make a fuss. You just want to try and articulate in adult language what they're seeing with their kid go through. But as soon as their kid gets a little older, it's all about practicing the advocacy skills. One thing that we do in Eye to Eye, our mentors, and then maybe it's a little easier because our mentors all have learning disabilities, they come in and they make a puppet. If the kid's young enough, they'll think this is fun. They make a puppet of perhaps their teacher or the person that they need to practice talking to for what they need. And then with this puppet, they'll role play, you know, kind of what they need to say and how they need to say it. And then they'll go and be able to do it. You have to also let kids fail sometimes. It builds resiliency, but you want them to fail in a safe way. So if you've kind of set it up so that the parent has done some pre-advocacy work with the family's teacher, and then the kid does that advocacy work, and if it doesn't turn out exactly as they would hope, to be able to say, okay, why did that not work out? And you learn from that. And you don't always get what you need. But over time, those advocacy skills build and build and build.
Can you talk a little bit about what you've learned or maybe what you remember from your own parents about discipline issues, particularly with ADHD? At what point did your parents say, okay, well, this behavior is likely caused by the disability? And at what point did they say, all right, you got to straighten up and fly right?
So inappropriate behavior was always inappropriate behavior in my family. And that was always really clear. But my parents were always pretty good to help me understand when they felt I was having behaviors that were inappropriate in such a way that we weren't going to be able to sort of function productively in our family household, right? So sitting still for long periods of time, my dad was in the food business for a long time, and he used to have even a small family dinner took, you know, four courses in 2 hours. And I just said, you know, at some point, with my ADHD brain, I am going to stop being a good family member. The kind that makes eye contact and listens to how everyone's day was. That is going to stop about 45 minutes into dinner. So mm-hmm. can we find some middle ground between my ADHD and your love for the culinary arts? And it was a constant conversation, and they understood. And so, you know, in light of, okay, we don't want Dave to have an ADHD outburst every night at dinner, they lessened the amount of time we had dinner. And I tried to, you know, be as on point as possible. So a lot of it is what I would call the environmental hygiene. A lot of my ADHD and dyslexic kind of faux pas were often in relation to the environment. The other side of it, if I wasn't paying attention, could be that there's just too much going on in the household. So if there was a baseball game on that my dad wanted to watch, and you know, in the meantime, you know, we had the dog barking, and then my mom asked me how my day is. I don't know. There's too much coming in. Mm-hmm. So parents can really do a lot to help their kids be productive by just changing the environment. Schoolwork is definitely that way as well. You know, if kids are struggling to get their work done, if the environment at home is super distracting, helping them, you know, turn off the cell phone, maybe remove themselves from the computer unless they need it for the work, those kind of environmental changes can be game changers for kids.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Scott on the line in Allen. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am relating to you not in the dyslexic way, but in the ADHD way. Your entire story, I feel like it's mine, except for I was diagnosed with ADHD in the third grade, and through until I graduated high school, I was prescribed Adderall. Mm-hmm. And it was around middle school where I started falling out of what you were calling the smart crowd, and I was starting to struggle a little bit. And after high school, I decided I didn't want the medicine anymore. And I started struggling in college to find ways to cope with my ADHD. And I'm wondering if you were ever medicated with Adderall or Ritalin or all the others.
Well, let me jump in there, Scott. We have to take a quick break. Dave, if you can hang on to your answer until after this, we will get it in just a moment. My guest is David Flink, co-founder and CEO of Eye to Eye, and author of the new book, Thinking Differently, an inspiring guide for parents of children with learning disabilities. You can be part of our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with co-founder and CEO of Eye to Eye, David Flink, author of the new book, Thinking Differently, an inspiring guide for parents of children with learning disabilities. Before the break, we heard from Scott, who was curious as to whether you ever used medication to manage your ADHD.
Yeah, so I had a whole slew of different medications that were prescribed to me as I was growing up. Adderall, Concerta, you name it. And what I would say to Scott, and I appreciate that he also shared his story, and to anyone who's sort of thinking about that medicine route, I like to think about medicine as an accommodation. So when I was in school, Adderall was absolutely essential in order to help me essentially sit still for 8 hours a day, which is what we ask our kids to do in most schools across America. As I've gotten older, I actually don't take meds anymore. But my environment, again, coming back to the environment, my environment has so dramatically changed. Ever so often, I'll be asked to go to a conference where I'll, you know, have to sit still again, like almost in the classroom setting. And oh, how I wish I still had my Adderall prescription, which has since fallen well expired. But I know families really struggle with that. And all I can say is if whatever it is that your kids need, whether it be medicine or a squish ball or an audio format for reading, whatever it is, if your kid does better at it, use it. There's no accommodations that are bad.
We have an email here from Ray who wants to know the best way to explain to a child that he or she is dyslexic.
So I like to imagine in the ideal world how it could have been when I was first diagnosed. And in my imagination, it would have been like a family party. It would have been all of my dyslexic brothers and sisters coming in and saying, hey, we didn't, you know, we missed you. And I think that you can create that a little bit with your kids. So I think using really simple terms is helpful. So the word dyslexia feels scary. You need to use the word, or you need to use, you know, whatever the learning disabled word is, so that the kids know that they have that word to get their rights. But then you need to get very simple after that. So to say something like, for me, okay, you have trouble sitting still. That thing is called ADHD. Lots of people have it. And let me talk to you about some of the people who have it. And starting with people that they may know, like celebrities, and getting very intimate very quick. Particularly as we start, you know, telling our stories, they can say, hey, you know, I was listening to the radio today and this guy Scott called. Just, you know, we don't know much about Scott, although Scott, you sound like a nice guy. But he'll say, you know, people all around us have it. Because I think the thing that often lacks is community. So being able to use really simple terms, like you're going to have trouble paying attention for a long time, but that's common, and we have some ideas about how to make your school environment better, and maybe your home environment too, because it's not just related to school.
All right, let me ask you this. Ideally, we would all be great at everything, right? We would all just soar through school and have no problems.
Yes. The truth I'd love is, that world.
Right. With or without diagnosed disabilities, we all have strengths and weaknesses. In terms of focusing education, are we better off helping children to really cultivate their strengths than spending a lot of time trying to get them caught up to, you know, some arbitrary standard that maybe the state or maybe someone else has decided you need to achieve?
You know, I have a friend who often talks about how interesting it is that in school we talk about cognitive and non-cognitive skills, but we don't talk about social and non-social skills. And one of the things that I think can be important as we're thinking about the purpose of education is remembering that the social skills are as important as the cognitive skills. So not kind of calling them, oh, those are the non-cognitive skills, they're not as important. The social skills are really important. And I think one of the things that we can do a better job, but that families can start to do at home even, is to help develop those social skills so it becomes less a conversation about does every kid need to be an expert on everything, because we know that's not possible. And in fact, that'd be horrible. We want people to become specialists. When we get older, we actually do well if we become specialists in what we do. So having kids understand their social skills, the abilities to know themselves well, to know how they think well, to be able to ask for what they need, those social skills will do them far better than being really good in science and really bad in math and not knowing why that's the case. And I think that there are some schools that I've seen that are starting to do a better job of that.
We have an email here from Gary who says, I have students read aloud for a workbook exercise, and I know some are anxious and don't volunteer to read. What can I say to the class that would put those who don't volunteer at ease?
Those who don't volunteer at ease. So I think it's actually it's a great question to follow what we were just discussing. I think it's important to be able to start off the conversation with the idea that, you know, some people are better at some things than others. And why are we reading out loud today? You know, what's the purpose in that exercise? Is it so that all of us have a chance to kind of hear and experience the story? Okay, great. Well, in that case, those of you who really like reading out loud, that's your gift, that's your skill, you're going to be our leaders today. You're the ones who are going to shine. And if you don't want to read out loud, that's fine. Some of the people who choose not to read out loud very well might be the kids with learning disabilities. It might just be some kids who don't like to read out loud. Maybe they're shy, or maybe they don't like the way that their voice sounds. And then guess what? 20 minutes later, there's definitely going to be another activity where the kid who didn't like to read out loud is going to be the leader. And it's important that we allow all kids to find a place to shine. And I think all teachers, and I'm sure my mom is a fourth grade teacher, and I learned this from her. You know, every kid has something that they're really great at. And just making sure that every day, every kid has a chance to be a superstar in a moment. So that's my advice.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Melody in Lindale. Hi, Melody.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yes, thanks. I am now 58 years old, and I guess I was the first generation of clinical being knowledge with learning disabilities. I was very fortunate to be raised in Chicago, and my mother read an article in Women's Day Red Book and took the article to my principal in my grade school and said, these are my children. Do you know anything about it? And she said no, but she found it. And like I say, in 1970, I was on a first grade reading level until I was very fortunate to go to the Dyslexia Institute of Chicago. And this gentleman's life work was working with dyslexics. But it's been hard. And like I said, I returned back to junior college at age 46, and I could not get any accommodations because I was diagnosed so long ago there was nothing in my record. So it took me like 6 years to get an associate's degree, but I hung in there and, you know, it took it from there. But
well, good for you for sticking with it, Melody. It does sound like what Melody's talking about reflects that our awareness of these challenges has certainly grown over the decades.
Absolutely, and I love your story, and I'm so humbled to whenever I hear someone who's had such great resiliency. I think that's perhaps a trait within the dyslexic ADHD Republic. But you know, when I hear that story, what I think about is that learning disabilities might be our next big civil rights issue, because a lot of it is about access and the fact that to actually get the accommodations you need in school, you actually have to be re-diagnosed every 3 years. It's almost like a fee for having a learning disability, which is ridiculous. And I think that's something that we can address because having a least restrictive learning environment is something that everybody deserves to have. And I agree that the awareness is super important. And this, I mean, I'm so appreciative of this hour that we've had together because everyone who's listening, I suspect, is going to have an increased awareness on the fact that learning disabilities are super common.
What about applying for a job? Obviously, you're not required to say you have a learning disability. Is it something that you ought to get out in the open in the beginning? Should you wait until after you have shaken hands and accepted the deal?
So I think there's still some misunderstandings around learning disabilities. Hopefully, maybe we solved it all in this hour. I don't know. But
wouldn't that be nice?
That'd be great. But let's say that we did it for now. We'll see what happens in an hour or so from now. And I think we have to understand that not everybody understands what those words mean. They don't sound like exciting words. And in fact, I share a story in the book where my first job, I was an admissions officer, actually, at Brown University. And my job was, believe it or not, to read all day. That's what I did for a living. And so I wasn't the first person in the interview line to say, hey, I have a disability in reading, because I knew with the appropriate accommodations, I would be able to do well. But so I didn't say it in the interview. I got the job. I didn't say it the first or second or third week even into the job. But by about the fourth week, my dyslexia was catching up with me, and so was my ADHD. And then I went to my boss and I said, you know, we didn't talk a ton about this. I'm more than prepared to do the job. And because I've come this far in my education, I know exactly what I need to be successful. I just need some accommodations. I didn't say, by the way, you know, the ADA protects my rights and I can sue you if you don't give, you know, you don't want to start with that tone. And I didn't ever have to because I had a great boss. She said, we just want you to be successful, David, and we want you to do the job well. And very quickly, they set up a number of accommodations that were helpful for me. And then I flourished in the job. I did it for 2 years. The only reason why I left was because I was ready to start eye to eye.
I loved your story, actually, that you had a cube mate who would sail through her work so fast, and then she would, you know, be chatting with her coworkers all day. And you finally said, can I do some of this from home where I won't be distracted?
Yeah, that was actually I thought the part of that job that was going to be the hardest was the reading. And in fact, it turned out because of my my coworker, it was my ADHD that was challenging because she just liked to read all of her files for the applicants out loud. And what was so great about that moment is when I went and talked to my boss and I said, you know, I have ADHD and it's very distracting with this coworker. And also the placement in the office was just incredibly distracting. There was always noise around, lots of people coming back and forth, which was just so hard. I said, you know, all I really need is to read my files from home. And her response initially was, well, we can't do that because we'd have to do that for everyone. Again, kind of coming back to that issue of fairness we were talking about earlier. And my response was, that sounds fine.
Yeah. Why can't you do it for everyone? Right.
Yeah. And so she did it for everyone. And guess what? Actually, most people are more productive when they're not distracted by their colleagues at the water cooler. And so everybody got to take their files home and everybody read more productively. And I don't know if they still do that policy there. I wouldn't be surprised if they did, because a lot of times the accommodations we ask for in life are really good for everyone.
Were you always aware that this wasn't something you would grow out of?
No. And I think I was born in 1980. And at the time, there was a lot of discussion about overcoming, you know, overcome your dyslexia, overcome your ADHD. And so I thought, like, oh, when I turn 18 and, you know, go off to college, it's just going to go away. And there was a moment, I think, where I was maybe disappointed that it hadn't gone away when I actually started to struggle in school, because I, you know, needed to get the same things in college that I had in high school. And then I realized something. Some of my favorite parts about myself come directly from my dyslexia and my ADHD. And there's actually a terrific book out called The Dyslexic Advantage, which was written a couple of years ago. And I definitely recommend reading it, because it's written by these two physicians who, they, with science, have studied all the amazing gifts that lie in the dyslexic brain. And I think we're going to see more and more science like that coming out in the years to come.
Talk a little bit about Eye to Eye and how the mentoring works that you provide for students, how it would be different from any other kind of mentoring.
So the magic of Eye to Eye is that we don't have to train any of our mentors at what it means to have a learning disability, because they already have it. They're all college students who are sort of innately cool in the eyes of a little kid. Mm-hmm. And we train them on how to be a mentor, how to be an effective mentor. And we have a very robust Eye to Eye curriculum that lasts over a year, where the mentor works with their mentee in the school. But the secret sauce is absolutely that the mentor sits down with this kid and says, hey, I know what you're going through. And in many ways, the reason why I was a mentor in Eye to Eye and why I continue to do the work that I do in Eye to Eye is I was so acutely aware of the fact that my life would have been dramatically different if I had known just one person who was a little closer in my age that could say, I've been in your shoes. So that's really the crux of our work. And we have 57 chapters in 22 states. We don't have anything in Texas yet. So anyone who's listening and wants to maybe help us get something going on in Texas, I hope they'll reach out to us at eyetoeyenational.org, because we're everywhere and we just need to kind of know each other and tell our stories. And that's how we'll make big change happen.
I have to imagine there's also a little bit of magic for the mentors who maybe look at these people they're working with and realize how far they've come.
Yeah, it's one of the probably best surprises for me in watching Eye to Eye grow. I remember when we first started, I thought, oh, I'm going to go help this kid, but obviously I don't have anything to learn. Well, that was a complete mistake. My mentee taught me so much more about how to be proud of myself and how to be successful. And some of the things, you know, you asked me at the beginning of this hour, when did I start feeling smart? And I said, oh, you know, any day now. You know, we're catching kids at a very young age where they haven't had any of these negative feelings. Mm. I just had a student come up to me recently who'd been in Eye to Eye and said, you know, is it bad that I haven't had any challenges, any trauma? And I said, that's wonderful. That's the goal. And so I think there's definitely some magic with our mentors as well. And of course, the mentees are huge benefactors, as well as the families. And now in this book, I hope that parents feel like they get to have a mentor of their own in these pages.
David Flink is co-founder and CEO of the student mentoring organization Eye to Eye and author of the new book Thinking Differently, an inspiring guide for parents of children with learning disabilities. Dave, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, an absolute pleasure. Anytime. Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.